Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here with us today. Today's topic, everybody wants to know about bees and beekeeping, because I'm sure that you want to know how they work, how to approach one. Many people have thought about owning one. Some people are fascinated or maybe even allergic and want to know, what do I need to do when I get near one? So we brought in the expert, the Virginia Master Beekeeper, Ken Hall. He's the current president of the Central Virginia Beekeepers Association, and he's been a beekeeper for 25 years. Ken, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
My first question is, how do you get to be a Virginia Master Beekeeper?
So a lot of states have master beekeeper programs through their state beekeepers association, and Virginia is one of those. They actually have a pretty rigorous program. The master beekeeper program here in Virginia goes through three phases. You start out as an apprentice, you proceed on to being a journeyman, and then you can become a master. Now, at each level, you have written exams you have to take. There is practical field work that you do out in the bee yard. And for the master level, there's laboratory work with a microscope to do and an oral exam. So it's quite a bit of material to go through.
Goodness gracious. Okay, well, I'm going to scratch that off my list of dues. So, Ken, what got you started with bees? I mean, some people, it's you want to do it as a kid, and others you find it later in life. I'm curious what got around your brain to make you want to do it.
Yes, I guess I'd be one of those later in life people. There were really two things that got us into beekeeping here. Our then 7-year-old, for some reason, caught an interest in the idea of bees and was talking bees. And we were also gardeners, did a lot of gardening, and we were noticing that we just weren't getting the set of our vegetables and fruits the way we'd expect, because we weren't seeing bees. So I actually worked with a gentleman who was a beekeeper and got involved that way. And so it's turned out to be a really good experience for us.
Are there ancient myths or stories that brought you into beekeeping, or maybe your 7-year-old into beekeeping, that you can share with us?
So, you know, like I said, I am honestly not sure what got our 7-year-old turned on. But, you know, you mentioned ancient myths. The honeybee has been involved, man has been involved with the honeybee for, you know, thousands of years now. You know, there are cave paintings from 8,000 years ago that show man interacting with bees. And, you know, not surprisingly, in a variety of cultures, the bee became a sacred creature, tied in with the religions of the day. One of the ancient myths that I particularly like, going back to ancient Egypt, if you go back about 3000 BC, the Egyptians thought that honeybees came from the tears of the sun god. And the Egyptians turned out to be really the first real beekeepers. They took it real serious. You'll see lots of hieroglyphics with regards to beekeeping. Southern Egypt was known as the beekeeping kingdom. And a number of their sacrifices actually involved dumping honey into the rivers for sacrifices to the sun god.
I was, not to jump too far ahead in the world of time, but I was watching a British crime drama I guess, and someone, one of the characters was a beekeeper, and he passed away, and somebody in the family said, we need to go tell the bees. And it, do you know what was going on there? Because I had to go look it up.
Yeah, so, you know, sometimes with some of the folklore, it's hard to know the exact start of some of that. But, you know, bees were always flying away from the hive. They were always in movement. There is, you know, beekeepers of the day, they learned to manage their hives in such a way that the bees weren't aggressive with them the way they were with others. So there was this feeling that they had to be attached to the family, you know. So this, you know, the idea of, like, if the beekeeper died, you had to go tell the bees that that had happened, or if there was a certain event like a birth or something like that. But, you know, obviously there's no substance to any of that. But you know, like I said, I think it all comes back to the idea of the bees being the messengers.
Well, again, our guest today is Ken Hall. He's the current president of the Central Virginia Beekeepers Association. You can go to the website if you want to learn more about the group, centralvirginiabeekeepers.org. And Mr. Hall has been a beekeeper for about 25 years himself. So, Ken, can you tell me some of the more interesting facts or I don't know if incidents is the word we want to use, that have happened to you personally in 25 years?
In 25 years, the more you learn about bees, the more you know you don't know about bees. So bees are constantly teaching me that, you know, just because you read it in the book doesn't necessarily make it so. And I always say it's because bees don't read books, so they don't know how they're always supposed to act. And I've learned, people will ask me a lot of questions about bees, and the first two words I often start with in any answer is, it depends. And it's not because, you know, I don't want to take a stand on what the bees would do, but it's their behavior and what they're likely to do is very dependent on a lot of factors, whether it's weather, time of year, size of the colony, just so many factors to where there just isn't one answer. So, you know, beekeeping is not just a science, although there's a lot of science in it. There's a lot of art for dealing with that it depends phrase. So, you know, so I would say that's the general thing. They continually remind me that regardless of how much I know, there's still a lot I don't know about them. But they're a fascinating creature. You know, you look at them as an insect, but they're actually a pretty intelligent creature. It's not just an insect. They have a symbolic language. They've been shown to actually understand the difference between having something and having nothing, the concept of zero, and the concept of simple adding and subtracting. And they understand geometric patterns. And all this from a creature that, from spring until fall, that the workers are only living 6 to 7 weeks. So, you know, they may have a tiny brain, they may be an insect, but they're actually very intelligent members of the animal kingdom.
Tell me more. Explain to me how you and beekeepers understand that bees recognize zero and they recognize the difference between something and nothing.
So, To go into all that, Rick, we'd have to go into a bunch of university studies, but probably a little bit beyond the scope of today. But I can get you some information about that. But
you can tell us. But without going into the classroom, I would like to hope that you could share with us the general concept of a bee's behavior or reaction or change in pattern that makes scientists and beekeepers believe that that the bee is understanding zero or something versus nothing without having to show me 10 studies. Can you do that?
Okay. Sure. So, you know, a lot of the experiments that the researchers will run, they'll use, you know, sugar water typically as an attractant for the bees because it's, you know, similar to flower nectar that way. Flower nectar's water and sugars. And they will, you know, set up areas where they will take an object away from a group and have other, you know, let's say more sugar water at a different place. And the bees understand that something has been diminished and can look to something that there's more of. So in a simple sense that way. So, huh. And they're also able to communicate to others in the hive. I mentioned earlier that they had a symbolic language. So in the morning, the older field bees go out as scouts looking for nectar sources or pollen sources. And when they find something good, they will come back to the hive and do a dance on the comb that other foragers who haven't been out of the hive that day yet, they'll do a dance for them to indicate where to find the food source. So they do a figure eight dance on the comb, and the angle of the figure eight gives the direction for the bees to fly with regards to the sun. And the vigorness of the dance as they cross over in the eight indicates distance. So from there, the other foragers can fly off and find these other sources. But as those sources diminish, they will inform the rest of the colony that, you know, that's no longer a source to use. So this idea of language, being able to tell others of their species where to find food, to my knowledge, there's only two members of the animal kingdom that are able to do that. There may be others that I don't know of, but the only two that I know of are honeybees and humans. And so it's sort of hard to think of in one aspect that you have an insect on the same level as a human. But in this case, it is. You know, for other animals, they either have to lead others of their species there or leave a trail like ants do to follow. But the bees actually have a language just the same as we do. And that's been demonstrated through a lot of experiments that's true.
Wow. I didn't recognize that it was just bees and humans with the communication factor. Again, Ken Hall here as we talk about bees, and we're going to get into beekeeping in a short while. Ken, speaking about beekeeping, you've been beekeeping for 25 years. Can you tell us a little bit about your personal setup? Are you willing to do that? How many hives you have and the process of taking care of that?
Well, you're putting me on a little bit dangerous ground here because my original agreement with my wife was not to have more than two hives, and way above that number now.
So she only knows about two?
Well, I've kept a two in the number. I usually have between 20 and 25. So there's a two there. It's just in the wrong position. I have bees in several different locations here in Albemarle County. Before the pandemic, I typically have bees in Southern Maryland as well. We maintain several observation hives that we use to go to schools or fairs. Those are hives with plexiglass on the sides that allow you to look inside and see what the bees are doing. So that keeps me with plenty of work to do with those hives. So, and in our case, we use our hives. We don't sell any bee products at all. We do a lot of outreach to schools and organizations, and we decided long ago not to spend the time selling, that we wanted to have time to talk with people about bees and all of that. So all of our beekeeping that way is oriented towards public outreach.
Okay, so wait a minute. You have 20 hives, and they all make honey, right?
We wish they all made honey, but you know, beekeeping is like anything in agriculture. You've got some fields in agriculture may yield a crop. You may have a crop failure in another field. So any beekeeper that's got a number of hives, some of them will be good producers in a particular year, and others you might have to feed them yourself to keep them alive. So it's quite a range. If in Virginia, and Virginia is kind of known as a honey poor state, actually, as far as yield per colony, but the average yield per colony in Virginia is about 35 pounds a hive. So that means you may get, you know, twice or three times that from a particular hive, and another three or four hives, you get little to none. So it's a lot of variation in what the colonies are doing.
So you said Virginia is a honey poor state.
Yes. So the honey, to make honey, the bees need to bring back nectar from flowers. And take central Virginia as an example. We start getting a lot of nectar coming into our hives sometime in the month of April, and usually by about the middle of June, so we're about there now, the amount of nectar really cuts off. So just because you see flowers blooming does not mean that those flowers are producing nectar that the bees can use. So we actually have a pretty narrow range of time that the bees can be making honey. Other states like the upper Midwest, where there's a lot of canola and sweet clover, their average yield per colony could be in excess of 200 pounds. So that's why I was saying, by comparison, Virginia is kind of a honey poor state as far as what we can produce per colony.
All right, so let's take our first break. Again, Ken Hall here, letting us all know about bees and beekeeping. In fact, when we come back from our break, let's jump into learning more about beekeeping itself. If you want to get started, if you're thinking about giving it a try, or you want to know how your neighbor made it happen. So let's take a break. Be right back. And thank you for being here with us on another Sunday morning wake-up call. Always thankful to the folks at 97.9 The Wren. Glad to have a spot here on the station. Ken Hall with us, current president, Central Virginia Beekeepers Association. Ken, what does the CVBA do other than, you know, I have this image of beekeepers getting together and talking about how their hives went or exchanging jars of honey, and I'm sure that's not what goes on.
Well, that is part of what goes on. Certainly, you know, we have monthly meetings, which anyone's welcome to attend. After the pandemic and we're all back together, that will certainly be easier. But during the pandemic, we've met in a virtual sense. But you know, in those monthly meetings, we do get together. We typically will bring in a speaker to talk about a particular topic. There's always new things to learn. There's new things going on. But beyond that part of it, within the club, we do a lot of mentoring of the new beekeepers. Getting into beekeeping is not that hard. Staying in beekeeping is what's the difficult part, and particularly for the newer beekeepers to have mentoring to help get them up the learning curve and increase the probability of their hive surviving the winter, you know, is an important thing to do. And then we also get involved in different outreach events, whether it be county fairs. Our group typically supports both the Albemarle and the Fluvanna county fairs each year, a variety of other different special days that communities have. And then we do a lot of outreach to schools. So if you look at it from the standpoint of education, mentoring, and outreach, those are really the key things that we're doing as a club. The beekeeping clubs are just so important in the state for being able to foster those things.
Tell me about going to the schools. I'm curious what grade level you're going to and what sort of questions you may receive.
All right. Well, over the course of time, it's the outreach to school is something my wife and I do together. We've done everything from preschoolers up to a case where we went to the University of Virginia for a discussion. It seems like fourth graders in particular are something that we see quite a few of. Sometimes the kids are initially afraid of the idea of bees. So part of what we try to get through to them is just how important the bees are to their existence every day with regards to what they mean with regards to the food supply. We carry an observation hive with us, so we're able to show them how the colony is working. They're able to see the queen. In each case, we will talk to the teachers about what their curriculum is, and we try to customize the talk to each of the classes rather than giving, just a certain canned talk. The kids, they're always asking about, do we ever get stung? And they'll ask about honey. But then sometimes they'll actually ask some probing questions about plants or something that we have to scratch our heads. And we always tell them that if they can stump us on something, that means we have homework. So we have to go back and find out what it was, and then we'll send back to their teachers what the answer was. But we find a lot of times where initially kids are pretty afraid of bees, and those are the ones that are right up with their, up at the observation hive and won't go away from it by the end of the presentation.
Are kids any different than older adults in that sense, in terms of being afraid of bees?
I'd say that answer is no. It's just that maybe the adults don't admit it as much, but we see that with a lot of adults too. There's this thought that, the honeybees, they have stingers, so they've got to be aggressive, and if they're around me, they're going to sting me, and that's just not the case. The honeybee dies when she stings, so they only sting as a last resort. So that's something we try to get across to the to whoever we're speaking with. Be calm around them. Don't swat at them, and you'll do fine.
Good time to toss this out there. I found this little tidbit while doing my own homework for the show. Jupiter, king of the Roman gods, is said to have given the honeybee his stinger to protect his honey. His wife Juno, however, insisted there must be payment for this gift of a weapon. So Jupiter gave the stinger with the condition that the bee dies should she use it.
Right, which is true. Now, I think in the time of the Romans then, they actually thought that the bees, the workers, were males. So the concept of Jupiter giving his stinger to a bunch of females might have been a little different than the culture of that day. But they learned, you know, it was learned later that actually the honeybee colony is almost entirely female. There's very few males in a colony. And regardless of the species of bee, males never have stingers, only the females.
Are you saying that Jupiter wouldn't have given a stinger to a bunch of women?
I'm just speaking of the day, not today. But of that day, that's probably what would have happened.
Oh, goodness. So let me ask you a couple questions that came to mind while you were talking about the younger kids in the schools. How many times have you been stung?
So I tell them that I get stung every time I make a mistake, but I don't make many mistakes. So when I'm working bees, I do wear at least a veil over my head, usually a bee suit, but I don't wear any gloves to protect my hands. So if I'm going to get stung, it's usually from inadvertently pinching a bee when I've got my hands down in the hive. But in working my hives all through a yard, I'll get anywhere from no stings at all to maybe about four. At this point, I can get stung and sometimes not know where the stinger, you know, where I got stung. You know, I don't react very much to the bee venom anymore.
Pretty impressive. And do bees have favorite plants to gather nectar?
So they do. So different bees, you know, there's more than just honeybees. You know, all together, there are about 4,000 species of bees in the United States, of which the honeybees are not one of the native ones. But different bees have different length proboscis. That's their, you sort of think of it as their tongue for sucking up nectar. They have different lengths, and some of them have the ability to actually buzz a blossom to knock the pollen loose. So take tomatoes as an example. The tomato blossoms, to be pollinated, they have to be what's called buzz pollinated, and honeybees are not capable of doing that. So you won't see honeybees on a tomato blossom, but you will see bumblebees because they are able to do the buzz pollination. There are other flowers, like a sunflower is an example, that many different bees, in fact, probably most, can work the sunflowers. But there is, you know, some specialization between different species and plants, and then others are, you know, very general. And there's more than just bees as far as the flowers. There's all, some are pollinated by flies, some by beetles, and, you know, other things. So
many people actually recognize that. I think many folks think of the bee as doing the pollinating, not the fly or anyway, Ken Hall here today, Central Virginia Beekeepers Association, where he's the current president, as we talk about bees. So let's get into beekeeping. Ken, you've been doing that for over 25 years. You have two hives. So can you give us some pros and cons if I'm considering starting up my own beekeeping backyard? Can you give me some pros and cons of having bees?
So one of the pros is if you really enjoy being out in nature and working with creatures, beekeeping can be a great hobby to have. It's like a lot of hobbies, you know, just like there aren't too many people who make money off of golf. There are some who do, but not many, and it's the same way with the beekeeping. So I guess a con would be you're not going to make money out of it, probably. But, you know, I've never worried about the red ink with my own hives because I get enjoyment out of working with the bees. I'm not looking at making a profit off of it. Another con, if you want to look at it, is they are livestock. You know, it's sort of difficult to think of an insect as being livestock. You know, when it comes to cows or goats or chickens, you readily recognize them as being livestock. But given all of the pests and diseases that have come into our country, bees do not survive on their own for very long in the wild. I think the typical lifespan of an unmanaged colony is about 14 months or so. So you do have to treat them as livestock. So it's got to be something that you're willing to be a beekeeper with the bees. You can no longer be a bee haver with the bees. But also on the pro side, it is something that is a great teaching mechanism within a family. You know, if you attack it from a family perspective rather than just an individual doing it, because there's so much that you can teach the children using bees as the focal point for that.
Do you have a common misconception for me? Although really I'm not considering having, but I'll use myself as an example. For a listener, do you have a common misconception for any listener about possible beekeeping?
So the prime misconception, and I touched on that a moment ago, is that all you have to do is get the bees, put them out in the yard, let them do their own thing, and you'll collect honey when you get around to it. And where that might have been true if you went back 70 years ago, it's not true now. So that's a misconception that we have to counter with beekeepers all the time, that you do have their livestock and you do have to actively manage them. You can't just let them be on their own. They won't survive very long that way.
How much money does it take to get started? And keep going, I guess, because you said that if I just, or anyone, just gets bees to get started, it's just going to say, I think you said 14 months, pretty much on its own. So if a listener wants to get, I guess, one hive and wants to get started, but wants to keep going without growing to a double digit number of hives, you know, what are we talking about here?
All right. So we always recommend new beekeepers start with two hives rather than one. It's a lot easier to compare two hives as to how they're doing. And there's a number of things if a colony's in trouble that you can actually use resources from another hive to help it out. But if you're looking to get started with two hives and you have nothing, so you initially have to get all your beekeeping equipment besides the bees, we tell people to count on about $800 or so for the two hives and the equipment that you need. And unfortunately, in Central Virginia, we have lots of black bear. So there are very few places in our area where you don't have to protect your hives against black bear, which involves putting up an electric fence. So we tell people to count on another maybe $200 to $400 to put a bee fence in place. So to get those two hives set up, you've got your bee yard set up to be bear-proof. You're looking at somewhere around $1,000 to $1,200 to get started.
And then if my goal is to keep it going for 5 years. I'd like to make this happen for at least 5 years and then give it to a friend or, you know, or someone that I met through the CVBA. What are we talking about in yearly costs?
So the largest cost you have after first getting set up, let's say that the regular cost, there's always exceptions, but the regular cost is treatments that you're going to have to do to the hive to keep the Varroa mites in check. This is a pest that came here to the U.S. Around 1987 from Asia. It looks like a little small tick that gets on the bees, and that's the part that unmanaged, they devastate the colony. The mite is not a natural pest of the honeybee, so that the honeybee has not developed over the millennia. So those treatments, you're going to look at, for your two hives, you're probably looking at another, you know, let's say $25 to $50 a year that you're going to have to do the treatments. But then no one stops with two hives, so then you always will look at adding something else.
It's like all good, fun things is you always want more, right?
You do, and you got to try that latest little contraption that you read about in the beekeeping magazines and stuff like that. So, but it's not, once established, there isn't a large cost. There isn't a large yearly cost if you're not expanding.
Should we put your wife on the phone to confirm that?
No, sir. I mean, when it comes to extracting honey, there is a cost to the equipment to do that, but that's another benefit that the Central Virginia Beekeepers Association does for our members, is we actually have extraction equipment that we share among the members, so it eliminates that cost.
Oh, so you can borrow it for a short time to use and return?
Correct.
Okay.
So it's a club investment rather than an individual investment. So from there, you're buying your jars and stuff to put your honey in, but the expensive part is the extraction equipment.
Got it. All right. Ken Hall with us. He's been a beekeeper for 25 years, and we're talking about bees and beekeeping. Hang tight. Be right back. And thanks for being with us again today, everyone. Ken Hall is the current president at the Central Virginia Beekeepers Association, and he's telling us about beekeeping, a lot of little tales and tidbits from his own yard. So, Ken, we were talking about the cost of things. I think I had read a while ago that you could order your beehive through the U.S. Postal Mail. Is that still true?
So pretty much to get bees delivered, it's overnight services now. So it's typically UPS and FedEx that are doing it as opposed to U.S. Mail. And this as far as buying bees from other places. So particularly in the spring, most of the bees that you would buy are being raised down south because the winter's over sooner down there. And you can order a screen box of bees. You get 3 pounds of bees, which is about 10,000 bees in a box, and have it shipped up. Rather than having it delivered, it's something you set up to actually go and pick up the bees there. And it's always interesting when you go to pick up your bees, and you'll see that they're a little bit worried about them. I've picked up bees where my package is all alone in a big empty room on a table, and I'm told they're in there. You can also buy queen bees that are shipped through. Some suppliers will still ship the queens in little cages through U.S. mail, but most of those now are express services as well.
So you said that you get a new hive in the spring from the south is sort of the stereotypical method of happen. So over the winter, how do you take care of your bees?
All right. So before answering that, we also can get bees locally. More beekeepers now are raising small colonies of bees that you can get, and also queens. So I wanted to mention that today we have more access to local bees than we had in the past. Still not the packages of bees, but the local bees.
I was curious about how you take care of the bees in the winter, because if people are traditionally ordering new hives in the spring, I'm guessing that it's similar to plant life, where you are rebuilding while things are refreshing and regrowing. So what are you doing in the winter while the hive is quiet or shutting down, et cetera?
So first off, honeybees, you know, they're a social insect, and they go through winter as a colony. A lot of other social creatures, so like bumblebees, will provision a queen to get through the winter. So they don't have a lot of food and stuff that they need to provision. With our bees that you're starting in the spring, you're building up that colony and where they have to draw the comb. They actually produce their own wax that they're making their honeycomb in the hive. They're storing their nectar and their pollen. And your job as the beekeeper is to make sure that if need be, that you supplement their food intake, particularly that first year, with sugar water to mimic the flower nectar, to get them up to the point where they have roughly 60 pounds or so of honey on the hive going into winter. Because that colony, in a really bad winter, they're going to need about that weight of honey. If it's a milder winter, it would be less that they would need, but you provision for the worst case. So the colony then is going to be consuming that honey over the winter. And any warm day, they're going to fly out. Any day that we have above about 50 degrees, you're going to see bees flying out from the hive. And then come spring, as things are going again, they're building back up. So once you have the hive set up for winter, coming out of fall, where you're in, say, October, early November, until sometime, say, late February, there's really not much you have to do with the beehives at all. They're going to take care of themselves that way. It's possible to lose some colonies during that time, but that's kind of nature in that sense. And one thing I should add on to something you asked me earlier about cost. In later, after your first year, if you're going to be making honey on the colonies, you will have to buy some additional boxes to put on top of the hive. So you may have several hundred dollars of additional cost later for those two hives to have the added boxes to put on the hive for them to produce their honey in, their excess honey. Because we're raising the bees to produce more honey than they need for themselves. And so what we harvest, you know, when I said the average per colony was 35 pounds, that's on top of the honey that we're leaving behind for them. So we're harvesting excess.
So Ken, as a listener is considering becoming a beekeeper, how do you tell if the property is a good fit for honeybees?
So most places, even small city lots, we actually have a lot of beekeepers in the city of Charlottesville on small lots. as long as you're not at sort of the bottom of a hill, hives can be made to work pretty much in any situation. There's some situations better than others, but honeybees are pretty adaptable. Particularly if you're in a city situation, you may have to plant some shrubs or maybe erect a fence to direct the flight path of the bees so that they're not flying directly over your neighbor's yards. So that's, if you're in a tight city situation, that's something you always have to take into account. And like I said earlier about if you're in an area with black bear, it's got to be in a place where you can erect an electric fence. So the bees, when they're out foraging, they're flying 2 to 3 miles, up to 2 or 3 miles from the hive. They can cover about 8,600 acres. So you don't have to worry about what your property is supplying for their food source. It's your property and everyone else in that 8,600 acres are contributing to that hive.
Ken, when you were with us earlier talking about going to the schools and the kids talked about food supply or had a question about foods and you were answering them about teaching with food supply, how would the world food supply change if bees diminished in number?
So bees, a lot of species of bees are diminishing in numbers. I mean, even our honeybees here in the U.S., we routinely lose anywhere from the low 40% to the mid 40% of hives every year. So beekeepers are constantly having to replace those in the spring. And then there are other species of bees, particularly bumblebees, that are a lot lower in numbers. So in the case of the honeybee, the honeybee is accounting for roughly a third of our food supply, a third of what you eat every day is either directly or indirectly linked back to honeybees. And the way we do agriculture on a mass scale, it's really honeybees is the only thing we can rely on for that type of pollination. There's 40 to 50,000 bees in a honeybee hive. Bumblebee hives are in the hundreds, and they can't be moved around easily, and the honeybees can. So it's really the honeybee that we're so dependent on with regards to the food sources. So if we lost the honeybee and we lost about a third of our food supply, we'd be losing a lot of fruits and vegetables. We would be a lot more dependent on crops like corn, which are wind pollinated. Things like we lose a lot of apples, so our diet would change as far as what we had. We really couldn't be the food supplier to the world that we've been up until now. So the societal implications of losing that degree of food and what it means with the haves and have nots in the world is pretty significant. So things have changed a lot.
Is anything being done in a strong and direct manner to either prevent the demise or to increase the number in a grand way of these bees whose numbers are diminishing?
There's several different fronts that's being worked. For the bee itself, there's a lot of work being done on genetics of the bees, trying to select for behaviors that a colony has that makes it more tolerant of some of the parasites and pathogens that they have to deal with today. But that is a very long-term process. It's an important one, but it's not an easy fix. We're a lot more attentive with our colonies now to up the survival rate that way. Our bee clubs with what they're doing, trying to educate. Part of our outreach to the public is to try to help them understand, that when it comes to like use of pesticides at home, they need to be doing that according to the label. Outreach and, just like a show like we're talking today is a way to reach out to the public and get them aware of the situation and do what they can do at home, whether that's planting flowers that actually provide nectar. A lot of your nurseries now label plants as far as whether or not they are important for bees or not. And again, using pesticides according to the label so that it's so that it can be done safely from a bee's perspective.
A few years ago, maybe even a decade ago, one of the major topics in the news was about colony collapse disorder. Can you give everybody the definition of that and then talk about whether or not this problem has gone away or been diminished itself?
Yeah, sure. So back around the winter of 2006-2007 is where this topic of colony collapse disorder came up. A number of commercial beekeepers were going to check on yards of bees that they had that just a couple of weeks before had been fine, and they went to the yard and basically no bees flying at all. And typically, if a colony dies for disease reasons, you'll have a lot of dead bees inside the hive. And if they die due to pesticide exposure, typically, there'll be lots of dead bees all outside the hives and around. But in this case, the beekeepers were opening up the hives. They would find the queen and a few bees in the hive, but the majority of the bees were gone. Plenty of honey was there. No dead bees in the yard. I mean, it was almost like most of the colony had been teleported somewhere. And the initial thought was this has to be some new disease that has gotten into the bees. I mean, everyone attacked it that way to come up with what was going to be, what was the source of the disease and how to fix it. As more and more study was done, it was determined that this was not a new disease. And that's why it's called colony collapse disorder as opposed to colony collapse disease. It was actually a phenomenon that was due to several factors that together sort of formed the perfect storm that allowed the situation to arise. They determined it was a combination of parasites, like I mentioned the varroa mite earlier, pathogens, all sorts of viruses and fungi and bacteria, some impact from pesticides, and also an impact in a number of areas from poor nutrition, where there was a lack of nectar and a lack of variety in pollen that was available to the hives. So once we understood that it was really a stress kind of situation on the colony and not a disease, then it was a matter of going after the stressors. So a lot more attention spent on ensuring that varroa mite levels were kept a lot lower in the hives. A lot more attention on educating people about pesticide use. And where needed, in areas with poor nutrition, supplements that we could do for the colonies with regards to pollen, for instance. So today, jumping ahead to today, you're probably the first person that's asked me about colony collapse disorder in more than a year. The I never experienced it in my own colonies, and in this area, it was very little at all. But nationwide, in fact, worldwide, it's nothing like it was before. You know, something that not that many years ago looked like it was going to be the beginning of life as we knew it, at the end of life as we knew it, now is basically more historical in nature. But we are still losing colonies at too high a rate. In fact, our rate of loss right now is certainly just as bad, if not worse, than it was those years of the colony collapse disorder at its worst. Wow. It just doesn't make news the way that it did when suddenly, field after field with thousands of hives and the bees had just disappeared. That was very newsworthy and got lots of attention. Somebody losing hives just doesn't have the same appeal, I guess, from a media perspective.
Right. Just a few seconds left, about 60 seconds. So can the Central Virginia Beekeepers Association will be at the Albemarle County Fair this summer, correct?
It looks like it, the Albemarle County Fair may not be doing a full fair this year. So we're actually thinking that that's not going to happen this year, but hopefully next year for sure.
Oh, my. Even with all the reduced issues on COVID-19? They're not going to go back to the full fair?
All right. So I don't want to speak for the fair. You know, I'm going by, what I've seen on their website and all, too. So I guess the best thing for me to say at this point, we haven't been asked to support the fair yet this year. But if we're asked, we would certainly support it.
Oh, well. Well, that was a very good way to put that. If you're not completely signed up, you don't know. And if you are asked, you'll sign up right away. I hope you get the opportunity. I was always a fan of the Albemarle County Fair. Well, thanks to Ken Hall for joining us. We certainly talked about how to become a beekeeper and help the planet or get close to nature or make honey or just help pollinate your garden, which is what apparently got Ken Hall started, president of the Central Virginia Beekeepers Association, and a beekeeper for 25 years, and now a Virginia master beekeeper. Ken, thanks for being here with us.
Yeah, thank you, Rick, for the opportunity.
All right, folks, see you next Sunday.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake-Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.